From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Vicky Chavez sought refuge in a Unitarian church in Salt Lake City last January, she was invoking a law, the law of sanctuary, that hasn't been on the books in almost 500 years. Chavez was facing deportation to her native Honduras, but instead of going to the airport, she asked the church to take her in, and they did. The historian Norm Jones told us the fact that Vicky believed this concept of sanctuary would give her shelter is remarkable. He says, clearly the cultural memory of a time when people in a church would protect an outcast is really deep. Today in the program, we're using Vicky's story to talk about sanctuary, how an ancient law fits into a modern time. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Vicky Chavez had been scheduled to leave the U.S. on January 31st. She arrived in the U.S. by train in 2014. The city in Honduras where she lived, San Pedro Sula, had been called one of the most dangerous cities in the world. She says she faced domestic and sexual violence and that there had been death threats made against her young daughter. Chavez asked for political asylum as soon as she arrived. She was denied in 2016. She appealed. She was denied that, too. She asked for one more stay of removal, and that was denied on January 30th. She was supposed to leave the country that next day. Instead, she ended up at a Unitarian church in Salt Lake City. Vicky Chavez sought sanctuary. It's a word that is packed with history and legal significance, and it used to be a thing, a law, though it hasn't been in place for hundreds of years. When it was, a person could approach a church and through various different procedures like ringing a bell or using a special door knocker, they could say something like, I claim sanctuary. As one of our guests today has said, the fact that a Honduran refugee in the 21st century would think an ancient, obsolete law could help her says something. So today in the program, we're talking about this idea and practice of sanctuary, and we're going to begin with Professor Norm Jones. Jones is a professor of history at Utah State University. He specializes in early modern English religion and law. He joined us from the studios of Utah Public Radio in Logan. Let's start with some basics. How far back does this idea go? This seems quite ancient as a concept.
As a concept, it goes all the way back into the Old Testament. So there are passages in places like Exodus that refer to sanctuaries of various kinds. So we know that not only in Judaism, but also in other ancient religions, there was a concept of the temples being sacred spaces, and the people who were fleeing for whatever reason might be allowed to take sanctuary there.
And the idea is that this place is God's place, and it's set apart from the world, and so it's a place of refuge, that these are separate spaces.
There are separate spaces, yes, because when you're in the presence of the God, you're not in the presence of your secular rulers, whoever they may be. And one thing about temples is that they were neutral territory. If you think about the problem they had when you have a society that lives by feud, you have to have some neutral spots where everybody is safe, or you'll never be able to worship the gods.
Say a little bit more about that idea that this was a place in these intense times of blood feuds where they would come to just sort of cool off a little bit. Because it seems like this idea of cooling off, you could even apply that to today, a space where let's all get a grip here for a moment and just find a space to think about this for a second.
Yeah, and in societies that didn't have external law enforcement like we have now, the most defense was provided by your family. And so it's a tit-for-tat kind of a world where if you do something to hurt a member of someone else's family, they are required to respond by hurting a member of your family. And if you kill someone, then they have to kill you. So having a place where you could flee until a negotiation could be carried out to cool things off was very important. And this remained important up into the High Middle Ages, really, until you get the emergence of powerful enough states that you can talk about law enforcement that is outside of families looking after families.
So let me ask you about how this becomes an actual law. I mean, one of the examples that we know, and maybe it's the best, maybe not, are these English sanctuary laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, the English sanctuary laws are kind of unique in the sense that they went further than most Catholic countries went, but they are certainly drawing on a tradition of sanctuary that is older in the Catholic community. And that tradition, of course, has to do with the church being larger than any other organization. It's an international organization. God is everywhere. God's priests are servants of God, not of the king. And so the separation of church and state, or what they classically call the theory of the two swords, applied everywhere in the sense that you were supposed to respect God's sanctuary. And if a sanctuary is to be a sanctuary, it must be a safe place for everyone to come into it. And so the church in general recognized this to be true, just as I said, going back into the Old Testament.
Yeah. And for a time, I guess the secular authorities, it did come to an end, but for a time, they respected this space.
Yeah, they did. Maybe because it had a great social value to the community. The classical sanctuary laws in medieval England, in essence, if you committed a crime, especially murder, you could flee to the church, you could be in sanctuary. But usually there was a limit of about 30 days. Usually there was, again, going back to Judaic times, there was a discussion of whether or not you deserved sanctuary. But if they decided that you deserved sanctuary, in English law, it was for a fixed period of time, and it was until you could leave the country. So you had to abjure the realm. And if you couldn't get a boat, you could wade into the surf up to your chin to indicate you had tried to leave the country, and then you could go back to sanctuary. So in that sense, it's rather different than the modern idea of sanctuary, because the sanctuary used in the medieval society was you agree to get out of town.
Yeah,
we won't kill you because you're going to leave.
It's interesting. So there was quite a ritual involved. I mean, one of the things I understand is that they in order to gain sanctuary, you would enter a church, and depending on what time it was, I guess there was a kind of a process. They would ring a bell, or they would sit on a special stool or bench, or there was this particular door knocker. I mean, it seems like they had these particular rituals associated with this.
Yeah, they did. Especially certain places were recognized by everyone as places of sanctuary, but you had to carry out the ritual to gain the sanctuary. You couldn't just run in. You rang the bell, you were in the right place, your right door, all of that. And then there was this kind of interview about whether or not you were worthy of sanctuary.
Did you actually go in and say, I claim sanctuary? Was that, did you have to invoke some kind of, like, some particular words to get this to going?
In essence, yes. Huh. I mean, you had to invoke your right of sanctuary. And once those had been said, of course, then you triggered the process, because until you had officially claimed it, they wouldn't know you were there for that. But even now, archaeologically, there are a lot of these places left. They're marked out as distinct places of sanctuary.
Say a little bit more, if you would, about this idea of abjuring the realm. I mean, they would allow you to have sanctuary, but as you said, they wanted you to leave. So they had to basically, as I understand it, and this is something you've talked about, they had to dress in the clothes of a penitent and go to a port. Again, here's another kind of protocol, a kind of ritual.
Yeah, you dressed as a penitent, so you wore a long white shirt, you carried a candle, and you know your deportment, your costume, everything told the onlookers that you had this right. And so everyone understands what you're doing. So there, you kind of carry the rite of sanctuary with you as you go to the port. So you're acting out a script that puts you in the role of I'm not sure penitent would be the right word, but you looked like a penitent.
Right. Now, talk about if there wasn't a ship, or there was no way to get out of the port that particular day. You kind of referred to it earlier, but I found it really fascinating.
Yeah, you had to act out your intention to leave by wading into the surf. So you got as far as you could possibly get to leaving the realm. But since there was no boat there, then you could come out again and wait for the next boat. But you had to be actively engaged in proving that your intent was to leave. One of the issues for these sanctuaries and why they finally come to an end has to do with people who didn't leave, because there were lots of, especially in cities like London, lots of people believed the sanctuaries were just where all the criminals hung out.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that there was both cases were true. You could see how someone claiming sanctuary or being within the bounds of sanctuary where the king's representatives couldn't go might find it a very convenient place to run their illegal operations.
So they were manipulating it, abusing it, the process.
Yeah, there was manipulation of the process, especially if they got very many people in sanctuary. You know, if it becomes a world in which it's a more porous thing, and by the late early modern period, that's what it had become. It's quite porous.
Explain what the neck verse is. This is something you've talked about before. This is interesting.
It's part of the separation of church and state. So if you are in orders in the church, you are not under the law of the king. You're under the law of the church. So the king can't hang you. So you commit a felony. You should hang as a felon. But if you can prove that you're in orders in the church, they won't hang you. They will simply turn you over to the bishop for punishment. And that was proven by the recitation of what was called the neck verse. It was to read a verse from the Bible in Latin, and it was always the same verse. And there are lots of stories about people learning enough Latin to say the verse so that they wouldn't be hung. Then over time, they keep stripping certain crimes from the right of clergy. And so if you did something, you could no longer claim the right of clergy. But it was a very useful sort of social outlet to claim this right, because in a world where basically there is no penance in a penitentiary, they hold you in jail until they either hang you or let you loose.
Yeah.
It was one way of short-circuiting the system to let people loose who maybe you didn't really think should hang, but the law was really extreme.
So how much of this is motivated, as far as you can tell, by the idea of mercy, and how much of it is just an assertion of jurisdiction or power? Because it seems like it's a bit of both.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of both. I mean, the roots are biblical, and so a good Christian has to recognize that there is sanctuary of some sort within the temple in the Judaic sense. But at the same time, the system, the authorities are looking at this as a classic place where they're going to quarrel with each other. So if you insist that the church is to be free from interference by the state, you can see why this would be a spot where we would say, yes, you can't come in here, you can't touch people that we have given sanctuary to. And you could also see the king not liking this at all.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. There were times when this was indefinite. As you said, there were times when you had to be out of there in 30 or 40 days or something like that. But there was a time at Westminster, you mentioned, when you could basically stay there almost as long as you wanted, or as long as they'd feed you, I guess.
Yeah, as long as they feed you. Yeah. That's and sometimes they would cut off people's food to get them to leave, but that's but the general principle of claiming that you can't be touched by the secular law while inside the precincts was what the church was defending. So they're not anxious to throw people out.
And we should point out, it wasn't just for protection. It was a place, this was a church after all, and so the idea was you were supposed to atone for your sins and seek God's forgiveness, I guess.
Yes, I think that's really important. Classically, the idea would be that you're in the church, you confess the sin. That's why you have sanctuary. You say, yes, I did it, but. So you've confessed the sin, and now you will do penance for the sin. And if we think about sanctuary, it might actually function more like a entering into a monastery in a way. You can't leave. you should be acting now at your penance.
So it's changed. It's evolved over time. There were different ways of recognizing it. There have been all of these rites and rituals associated with it. But by around, I think it's, you mentioned 1624, I think it was, mm-hmm. it ceases to be an actual thing anymore. Then the sanctuary laws, I guess, are abolished by that point.
Yeah, in English law, they're abolished at that point. The Protestants came along and, of course, didn't see this distinction between the sacred space belonging to the Pope and secular space. And, of course, the monarchs were perfectly happy to get rid of it as well. So, yes, it ends in England legally in 1624, but obviously the idea of the sanctuary, since we still have the word in modern English, you go into a church, you enter the sanctuary, the idea of the sanctuary continues. But it changes from being a legal status to being essentially a moral position.
Yeah. Say more about that. This is one of the things that you've pointed out, that it's embedded in our cultural memory now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that someone like Vicky Chavez would invoke whatever remnant of the idea is still there has some really interesting significance, it seems.
Mm-hmm. I think at the heart of this is the problem of the individual Christian conscience. That, according to Paul, you're supposed to obey your magistrates, but you're supposed to love God and Jesus. And those are often in conflict, because your rulers often do things which you in conscience, as a good Christian, may find objectionable, and that require you to do things that are contrary to your faith. And when they did away with the sanctuary as a legal concept, it was in part because of the interiorization of these Christian values. Mm-hmm. Everyone should live according to their conscience. And that often creates conflict with the state. Because we know about Puritans moving to Massachusetts because they can't put up with the English state. Even in the founding of the United States, we have this acting out of Christian conscience as preeminent over obedience to the state. And I think the modern sanctuary movement is coming out of that in conscience. I must do this even though I am told by the law of the state that I shouldn't do this. So it is conscience over law.
Interesting how it plays in modern society. And maybe you could say something finally about Vicky Chavez and where she fits in all of this, because she's now a part of this continuum, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, she has invoked this moral principle, that the Christians should not cooperate with what they consider to be immoral behavior. And having invoked it, she has a community that is in agreement with that. So the Unitarian community is very much in agreement with that. And they are open to doing this in many communities. And so when you have a religious group that says that we will live our Christian's conscience, and someone comes along and says, well, it's about time you showed that you're willing, mm-hmm. then you get what you got with Vicky Chavez. She is able to invoke this to a group of people who believe that, yes, indeed, it is their duty.
Norman Jones is a professor of history at Utah State University. He has a forthcoming book called Being Elizabethan. He's joining us from the studios of Utah Public Radio in Logan. I should mention we're launching a short film today about Sanctuary. It features Professor Jones. It's about Vicky Chavez, the woman who, with her two children, found Sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sanctuary. Sanctuary as an ancient rite of protection, but also how it's being invoked in modern times. Joining us now on the program is John Fife. He was a co-founder of the Sanctuary Movement. It was a response to the policies of the Reagan administration to deport refugees fleeing civil strife in Central America. In 1986, Fife was convicted on 3 charges stemming from his work. He was given 5 years probation. He's also the co-founder of the immigrant rights group No More Deaths and pastor emeritus of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. Reverend Fife is joining us from Arizona Public Media in Tucson. And John Fife, welcome to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I guess I wanted to begin to get your sense of connecting this ancient idea of the law of asylum or sanctuary to this modern movement. You see the connection fairly strongly there, do you?
Absolutely. What we invoked in 1982 was that ancient tradition that has been appropriated throughout history. Whenever human rights and human life are in jeopardy. So we simply reached back to that ancient tradition and appropriated it for the context we found ourselves in, which was the United States government in clear violation of refugee law and refugee rights.
Do you find it troubling or concerning that it finally did end? It didn't seem to work in the same way. There seemed to be a distinction between God's law and secular law seemed to get muddied, and the fact that they didn't practice it in the same way. I'm wondering what you make of that. Is that just seemed to be the difficulty in general of trying to take a moral concept and make it work in a secular community?
Well, yes. The reason that the ancient tradition of sanctuary was supplanted by the legal authority of the state, it basically happened when secular states became strong enough to appropriate that function of a judicial system and a way in which people could advocate for their rights instead of simply being subjected to blood feuds and revenge killings and all of the factors that Dr. Jones articulated very, very well.
I wanted to ask you about your own experience beginning in your seminary days. Let's go back to Pittsburgh. You were arrested for disturbing the peace when you were picketing some local slum lords. You were jailed in Selma with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the voter registration drives in the 60s. So this idea of activism, this idea of coming up against the law of the land versus, I suppose, the law of God has been something you've thought about a good part of your life, most of your life?
Absolutely. And the civil rights movement had a profound effect on not only my life during the 1960s, but my whole understanding of the necessity, the absolute necessity of an ethical and moral and faith act in response to the failure of the secular state to preserve and defend human rights and basic civil rights, which was the case during the civil rights movement.
So you see it as an obligation of faith communities to take up this role.
That's been true since the very earliest record of faith and sacred scripture and the stories that form a faith community. The very first act of civil disobedience, if you will, was when Pharaoh's daughter rescued Moses out of the river and saved his life from the decree of Pharaoh that all male Hebrew slave children, babies, should be killed. And the rest of the whole history of faith is the story of people of faith having to stand up against the powers of secular states or of empires in order to save human life and to follow the mandates of God.
One of the things you've talked about, Reverend Fife, is how this idea, Dr. Jones referenced it earlier in the Old Testament, we can see that God sets aside these cities of refuge, not only for the people of Israel, but also for strangers. And this idea of aliens to a place, strangers to a place, at least as we see it in Scripture, that was important for God to protect them, this idea of strangers. I wanted to hear you on that.
Absolutely. The idea of sanctuary just for the people of that particular society is clearly not a part of God's instructions for sanctuary in the most ancient times, but also throughout history. And that memory of the Hebrew people and of Christians goes back to the Exodus out of Pharaoh's bondage in Egypt. A rabbi colleague of mine back when we were practicing sanctuary said to me, "John, it only says once in Hebrew scripture in the Torah that you have to love your neighbor as yourself." He said, "That's because God knew we could get that." He says, "But God says 37 times in Hebrew scripture that you have to love the alien in your midst as you would yourself or your own family or your own people." He said, "That's because God knew we would struggle with that one." And so God says it over and over and over again. It's absolutely foundational to not only the practice of sanctuary, but the practice of loving the alien as one of your own.
What made you want to go to Arizona, to Southside? And as I've read a little bit about all of this, you and your wife weren't exactly on the same page about this at first.
Well, we were about Arizona or the Southwest. I had been sent, after my first year in seminary, to the Tonawatam Reservation to serve the church there during the summer months before I returned to seminary.
And you both loved that area.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
And I learned about the beauty of the Sonoran Desert and the multi-ethnic composition of the Southwest and the border region. And so I was eager to hopefully find a home and a vocation here in the Southwest.
When you were finally called to, or you received the offer, the possibility of going to Southside, what did you decide about that? Because now you had the opportunity to go to this place that you had seemed to have an affection for, but now also make that part of your ministry, I guess. This was a good opportunity.
It was a wonderful opportunity because Southside Presbyterian Church is located in the oldest and poorest barrio in Tucson, and it had a history of being a multi-ethnic congregation made up of indigenous people, Native Americans from four or five nations, Mexican-American residents of the barrio in Tucson, African-American people who had come to flee slavery and Jim Crow and segregation, and a number of Anglo people who cared deeply about being a part of a multiracial and multiethnic community. So it had a great history and a wonderful opportunity to be in ministry here.
Let's talk about what was going on in the 1980s. You decided to stay as this it becomes really tumultuous in Central America. There were these civil wars in Guatemala and El Salvador. People know about the intensity of those. Upheaval, of course, in Nicaragua. Central Americans start crossing the border seeking political asylum. Talk a little bit about what you were seeing. And maybe we could just talk about one particular incident as an example of this. This was in the summer of 1980. This was, in fact, July 4th of 1980. And a Border Patrol agent finds 13 bodies in the desert. Talk a little bit about this, because this seems like it was kind of a turning point for you in some way.
It was. We're talking about July 4th of 1980, when I think the temperature at Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, where those bodies were found, reached 115, 116 degrees. It was a group of 25 or 26 people fleeing the death squads and the massacres in El Salvador, who crossed with a coyote, who pointed to some lights in the distance and said, "That's Los Angeles. Just keep walking toward those lights and you'll get to L.A.
Wow.
And it was not Los Angeles. It was a copper mine in Ajo, Arizona. And during the first day trying to cross under those devastating conditions, 13 people died and the survivors were eventually located and brought to Tucson to treatment in the hospital here. And they asked some of us who had been pastors in that community to provide pastoral care for them. And that's the first time I heard the stories of why those people had fled El Salvador and mm-hmm. how their lives would be greatly endangered if they were deported back to those conditions they'd fled from.
I think you've mentioned that you didn't really know all that much about what was going on in El Salvador or Central America at the time. This was kind of your awakening. Is that fair to say?
It certainly was an awakening, but it was also a red flag. The church is a transnational institution. We have historic and current ties to the church in El Salvador and Guatemala. And so a part of my awareness had been that the military of El Salvador and the death squads there had gunned down the archbishop as he was saying mass earlier in that year. And that priests and women religious had been tortured and killed by the military of El Salvador, and that the church was a particular target of the persecution there. And so so all of that came together as I endeavored to learn more and more about the exact conditions and the exact history and causes of the conflict there.
That's John Fife. He's a founding member of the Sanctuary Movement and pastor emeritus of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. We've just launched a new Radio West film. It's called Sanctuary. It's about Vicky Chavez, who is now in Sanctuary with her two young daughters at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. You can watch it at radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about Sanctuary. We're talking with John Fife, a co-founder of the Sanctuary Movement and a pastor emeritus of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. Gosh, it was right around this time of the year, March, mid-March. It was March 24th of 1982 when you declared your congregation a public sanctuary. And I suppose it really caught on. By 1985, the whole sanctuary movement seemed to be not only catching on, but quite a thing. And I wanted to ask you, what was it like? How did it work, this movement in those days?
Well, it worked because communities of faith, Protestant and Catholic Christians and Jewish synagogues, understood the moral and ethical and faith imperative of the provision of sanctuary for refugees. The Reagan administration had refused to provide asylum, political asylum, for refugees who had asked for political asylum here in the United States after fleeing Central America. And the record by that time was quite clear that no one from El Salvador or Guatemala was getting political asylum because the Reagan administration was in political and military and economic support of the militaries and the oligarchs and the governments of El Salvador and Guatemala who were doing the killing of so many, not only church leaders, but people who had been pressing for some social change from the traditional dictatorships and oligarch rule in El Salvador and Guatemala.
You were arrested in 1986. The Justice Department indicted a number of people for conspiracy and shielding and harboring illegal aliens. What was your legal argument or your moral argument, or did you try to invoke both?
Well, we tried to invoke both.
Yeah.
Of course, when we declared sanctuary, we made the ethical and faith argument that the church had to protect refugees fleeing El Salvador and Guatemala because the Reagan administration had refused to grant them political asylum when the entire international community, including the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, had told the United States that these people are refugees and should be accorded that protection by the United States government. Beyond that, we had a great legal argument, we thought. The legal question was, if these people were refugees, we had committed no crimes. It's no crime to assist refugees, even if they are undocumented refugees, and to protect them. It's a crime if the government's case was true, that these people were not refugees. They were just illegal aliens, just economic migrants, people coming looking for work and not having any threat to their life or the security of their person, as the law says. We thought we had a great legal case until the federal judge who was hearing the case ruled before the trial opened that we could not say anything in our defense about United States refugee law or international refugee law or conditions in El Salvador or conditions in Guatemala or our religious faith. And so we had no opportunity to present that legal defense in that courtroom.
There's this term that we should talk about. It's often referred to as civil disobedience.
Yes.
You prefer another term, which was crafted by a good friend of yours, Jim Corbett, civil initiative. Explain the difference.
The difference is very important, not only during our provision of sanctuary in the 1980s, but currently as well. The principle of civil initiative, as we defined it, is the legal right. And it's important to understand we're talking about legality here. Mm-hmm. It's the legal right to protect the victims of human rights violations when government violates human rights. And that legal principle goes back to the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when Nazi officials and generals were on trial for the Holocaust and their crimes against humanity. And their legal defense that they tried to mount in the Nuremberg tribunal was, we were just following German law, or we were just following the orders of German generals. And up until that point, up until 1946, that had been the highest standard to which anybody could be held in a court of law. But it was the United States prosecutor at Nuremberg who argued that's not the highest standard to which this court is accountable, that there is a higher standard than the law of the state or the orders of a military department. And that higher standard is human rights and international law. And the Nuremberg Tribunal accepted that legal doctrine. And, of course, the Nazi officials were convicted of crimes against humanity.
Yeah.
And since 1946, that legal principle has been recognized globally. And is an entire body of law that does meet the higher standard of legal authority than the particular law of a secular nation or the orders of a particular military officer.
So it's not just a squishy, abstract moral concept. It's an actual legal right that can be invoked, is what you're saying.
Of course. And the situation we found ourselves in the 1980s was that the Reagan administration was in violation of United States refugee law, international refugee law, and fundamental human rights. And so we invoked not only the tradition of sanctuary, but on the basis of that legal principle that you must protect the victims of human rights violations when government violates human rights, and you must hold the government accountable publicly for those legal crimes against humanity.
Okay, so let's fast forward to where we are now. Earlier this month, the Trump administration sued California for its sanctuary laws. This is the first such lawsuit, at least in the recent history, against a local or state government over its immigration policies. Are you seeing the emergence of a new sanctuary movement? Are you seeing now the invocation of this assertion of these legal rights that you just talked about? What are you foreseeing in the coming months during this particular time?
Of course, what we're seeing is not only faith communities, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and Buddhist faith communities who understand clearly that they must publicly and nonviolently and actively resist the Trump administration's violations of fundamental human rights and international law by declaring sanctuary now. And they are joined and have been joined by cities and county sheriffs and the state and six states now who have invoked that tradition of sanctuary to preserve basic human rights of refugees and to preserve family values and the integrity of families that are threatened by the policies and practices of the Trump administration now.
Let me bring Professor Jones back into the conversation, Norman Jones, professor of history at Utah State University, because Professor, I wanted to get your sense of where you fix historically what's happening now in the scheme of things, like where we fit in the sort of historical arc of this story.
Well, I think that it's a part of an ongoing conversation that people of faith have been having with their governments for a very long time. You know, if you look at the history of the United States, just the United States alone, where do we want to start? We want to start maybe with the debates over slavery, because the debates over slavery provoked people, and especially Christians, to take stands against slavery. You know, beginning in the early 19th century, the abolition movement is led by the churches. And we see the same thing happening with other things like the women's suffrage movement. So, and the civil rights movement. The people of faith, people of conscience who are responding to some higher law are frequently in conflict with their states because the state has less of an interest in being moral, I guess is one way to put it. So the conversation goes forward, and I think it's fascinating that John was also in Selma. Because, of course, if you read Martin Luther King, it's all there. He's evoking great theologians. I always teach the letter from the Birmingham jail because the entire history of Christianity is wrapped up in the way Martin Luther King explained why he was in jail and asked why the other ministers, why they weren't. So it's part of the great faith tradition, and I don't think it'll ever go away as long as you have states that have interests that are not necessarily the same as the moral interests of people of faith.
Do either of you think that partisan politics has come into play in a way that it might not have in the past? I mean, we see a lot of ideologically conservative churches in the Bible Belt, for example, who might not exactly share the same kind of principle related to immigrants. And I'm just wondering what you think of that. Reverend Fife, what do you think about that?
Well, Dr. Jones is correct. We need to look at history. We need to remember that the Ku Klux Klan had two agendas, not only to enforce Jim Crow and segregation, but also it was an anti-immigrant position that said, we don't want any of those Catholic immigrants coming to Protestant white America to contaminate our heritage here. So it had not only a racist but an anti-immigrant basis to the whole history of Jim Crow segregation and anti-immigrant faith communities in the South and other parts of the United States. So we have to remember that it took Dr. King and the civil rights movement to challenge that entire history in the United States, and to also challenge the racist and religious basis for a lot of the anti-immigrant history of this country as well.
Professor, what do you think about that?
I agree with that completely. You know, the first great anti-immigrant movement in the United States was the Know Nothing Party, and it was aimed at Irish immigration. Why don't you want Irish people? Because they're Catholics. It goes on and on. So because the immigrant is always portrayed as the alien, and quite often one of the easiest ways to identify the alien is to say that they are going to undermine our spiritual values. They're going to be immoral, and so it's part of a long American conversation about who should be an American, and each generation of Americans, once they've gotten in, have a tendency to pull up the ladder and forget that they were the newcomers two generations back and that their faith was the alien faith. So unfortunately, so much of what we're hearing today, as the Reverend says, it's the founding of the Klan in the late 19th century, exactly the same stuff. The 1870s and 1880s, it's anti-immigrant. It's also in favor of tariffs. So this is a traditional American conversation, I'm afraid.
This brings us back around to Vicky Chavez. I wanted to end with her story and have you maybe both say something about where she finds herself in this story. Reverend Fife, you've talked about the emotional toll something like this must be taking for her. And the fact that she has to take such a decision, I think you've put it, of last resort.
Absolutely. The option of sanctuary, as Dr. Jones has pointed out from history, is not a great option. It's not a choice that one would normally make. You only do it as a last resort in order to protect your life or your family from much worse options under the circumstances. So Vicky is requesting and the Unitarian community is practicing sanctuary, but it originally, biblically and historically, has been an opportunity for the protection of the most vulnerable among us, so that conversations and negotiations can take place to resolve the conflict between state and faith community. And so Vicky's in a position now where hopefully she can begin to make her case that her life and the life of her family need to be protected by the secular state, and or that faith community may be in a position to publicly challenge the policies and practices of the secular state that threaten Ms. Chavez and her family. And so this is an opportunity for this very kind of public conversation to take place about our faith and our secular policies and practices and families and Vicky Chavez and her situation so that a good result may emerge.
It's John Fife, founding member of the Sanctuary Movement, pastor emeritus of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. Reverend Fife, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Norman Jones teaches history at Utah State University. He has a forthcoming book called Being Elizabethan. He joined us from the studios of Utah Public Radio in Logan. Professor, thanks very much to you as well.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And I'll mention we've just launched a new Radio West film called Sanctuary. It's about Vicky Chavez, who is now in Sanctuary with her two young daughters at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. You can go see it at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones. Tim Slover is our technical director. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.